Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Hinwood. In a world of mounting chaos and uncertainty, Behind the News is a rock of stability. Two guests, two segments. John Cassidy will talk about his new book, Capitalism and Its Critics, and Sandeep Vahisan will talk about abundance, neoliberal versus genuine. Capitalism went through a period of serious popularity from roughly the mid-1980s until the 2008 financial crisis, peaking around the mid to late 1990s. There were ebbs and flows, of course, but it was the time of TINA, there is no alternative. Privatization was all the rage, everything would work out if we could just get the prices right, the stock market could do a better job of supporting us in retirement than Social Security, etc., etc. I can say from experience that it was a lonely time to be a critic of capitalism. Times have changed. The system is just not terribly popular now, even if we have a hard time imagining an alternative or how to get there. Of course, it wasn't always so popular. John Cassidy, a staff writer for The New Yorker, is just out with a book, Capitalism and Its Critics, A History, From the Industrial Revolution to AI, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. It's not a small book, 624 pages to be precise, but it's highly readable, both because of John's clear prose style and because it's broken into about 30 chapters, each dedicated to a critic, in some cases critics, of capitalism, so you can consume a few of the little essays at a time. It's a very impressive book. The critics range from the familiar, Marx, Polanyi, Keynes, to the less so, like the early socialist feminists Anna Wheeler and Flora Tristan. The core of these critiques, as John puts it, is that over the centuries, the central indictment of capitalism has remained remarkably consistent, that it is soulless, exploitative, inequitable, unstable, and destructive, yet also all-conquering and overwhelming. Hard to dispute. I interviewed John about the book at the Center for Brooklyn History on May 15th. Here's an edited version of our conversation. So how'd you come to write this, and did you ever imagine it would turn out so large?
Good question. How did I start writing this book? The idea first came to me when Bernie Sanders was running for president in 2016 and Donald Trump was running for president. It seemed to me at that stage that that was more than just a sort of one-off, and that there was it was a sort of result of a sort of whatever had gone before had reached some sort of an impasse. And there was a story to be written about how did we get into that state. So I initially thought of it as a shorter book. I originally thought of it as a book telling the story from the end of the Cold War. But then I thought, oh no, not another book about neoliberalism. There's been so many of them. And some of them are very good, some of them are not. But I thought, that's not going to work. And anyway, it came to me as I was sort of started researching that a lot of the topics which come up if you start to address the sort of last 30, 40 years, like globalization, rampant inequality, worker exploitation, monopoly, consumer exploitation, they actually go back to the very beginning of the capitalist system, industrial capitalism. Someone wants to ask me how I define capitalism, happy to answer. But for these purposes, I'm talking about industrial capitalism, which originated really in where I'm from, in Northern England, in the late 18th century. So I kept going back, and eventually I thought, you know what? What the hell? Just do the whole kibosh instead of doing bits of it. So that was sort of, okay, that's good. I'm going to write a history of the last 250 years of the world. How do you do that? That was when I guess the sort of New Yorker side came into me. One thing they do bang into your head at the New Yorker, and I've been there nearly 30 years, is that if you want to tell a story, you better put some people in it. It can't just be a theme, you know, that's an idea. And as somebody who writes about themes, that's always the challenge. How do you sort of, they have a horrible phrase, how do you storify it? So how did I storify the history of capitalism? I sort of took a leaf out of one of the economists, sort of center-left economists that I met when I first came to New York 40 years ago now, Bob Heilbronner, who used to teach at the New School, wrote a book which is still in print, which first came out in the 1950s, I think, called The Worldly Philosophers, which is biography-based. And because of that, that's the reason it's still in print, I think. Now, he only covered the sort of totem poles, Marx, Keynes, Adam Smith. I thought, you know, I wanted to go a lot broader than that, both geographically and sort of ideologically. The challenge then was, you know, who do you pick? And I ended up picking about 30 of them, and they're the subjects of each chapter. Some chapters have more than one, most are one individual. And that's the base of the book. I say in the introduction, if there's a conceit about the book, or a conceit the book is based on. It's the idea that you can tell the history of capitalism through the eyes of its critics.
The late, great, and insufficiently well-known Marxist sociologist James O'Connor once told me that capitalism has been in crisis since the 13th century, which is one version of his birth date, though you accept the more canonical 18th century. It seems like the 30 glorious years, I won't inflict my French on anyone, the immediate post-World War II decades with their relatively egalitarian distribution of income and wealth and relatively stable cyclical behavior. The older among us thought that was like the new normal, but it turned out to be a brief exception in the history of capitalism. Does this system thrive on crisis? Is it wrong to see crisis as kind of its norm?
Well, I mean, as I say in the introduction, capitalism is always in crisis, recovering from a crisis, or headed to the next crisis. That's been true since the beginning. You know, in the 19th century, the crisis, mostly financial crises or commodity price collapses, they tended to happen about every 10 years. Because of Keynesianism and monetary policy and fiscal policy now, the crises tend to be more spread out. We didn't have a big crisis between the 80s and 2008 when we had a blockbuster crisis. I don't think it's that the system thrives on crisis. It's that its inner contradictions, to get Marxian about it, lead to crisis. The system is built on innovation and the profit motive. That combination of factors has proven incredibly durable and sort of innovative. I mean, you have to recognize the sort of creative power of capitalism, which Marx did. If you read the Communist Manifesto of 1848, first part of it is a sort of hymn to globalization and the sort of achievements of the bourgeoisie, as he said. The early critics of capitalism recognized its incredible sort of productiveness. How could you not? But allied to that are sort of tendencies to destruct. That obviously, on a long term, you know, it generates class conflict, generates financial crises. Now we find it's always generated pollution and externalities. Terrible economic term. It's always generated pollution and sort of noxious outpourings of all types that they seem manageable for a long time. Now it turns out, you know, they may be burning the planet. So, yeah, I don't know if it thrives on it, but it's, some people say it does thrive on crisis. The next crisis produces the next boom. One of the chapters is on Nikolai Kondratiev, who made that argument, a Russian economist. But it's certainly integral to the system, I would say.
Okay, let's talk about some of the individuals, the characters of the book. Adam Smith, a naive reader might ask, what's he doing here? Isn't he one of the big heroes and celebrants of capitalism? But he did have some issues with the system. So
yeah, I mean, the reason I put Adam Smith in there, two reasons, really. Number one, the book starts in sort of 1770 with a corporate crisis of the British East India Company, which was a monopolistic system at the time. It had a royal monopoly. It was a big corporation with a big headquarters on Leadenhall Street in London, where the City of London is now board of directors who sent out instructions around the world. It was a multinational corporation, but it predated industrial capitalism. So my first critic, William Bolts, is a whistleblower from the East India Company who, like a sort of big farmer whistleblower or something these days, basically told what was really going on out in India and the other places where the company operated. So I thought that was a great start to the book, because it reminds us that capitalism in various isn't just industrial capitalism. There was a pre-existing form of capitalism called mercantile capitalism, which was based on colonialism and protectionism. Donald Trump, his whole agenda is bringing back the 18th century or the 17th century mercantile capitalism. Aggressive economic nationalism. There were a lot of wars. Britain and Holland, which were the great trading leaders at the time, were always at war with each other. A very violent and protectionist system. Anyway, so they start in 1770, but then, of course, 1776, something happens on this side of the pond, of course, but it's also the publication of The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith. Now, these days, Adam Smith, as Doug said, is seen as the great apostle of free market capitalism. I used to be a Washington correspondent for my sins for the London Times back in the late 80s and early 90s. All the conservatives in those days used to wear Adam Smith badges. There was an Adam Smith Society, and to be a sort of bright spark in, young spark in the Republican Party, you had to have your Adam Smith badge on. But Smith himself, if you read The Wealth of Nations, if you read the introduction, he says, I wrote this book as a criticism of mercantile capitalism. So he was actually a critic of the capitalism of his day. He made the same arguments a lot of people in the sort of center ground are now making against Trump, that protectionism was bad, the free market would supply all these goods if we just took down all these tariff walls, and if we sort of unleash the magic of the market, you wouldn't need these abusive monopolies like the East India Company and the Dutch East India Company. So in his own time, he was a critic of capitalism. So that is why he's in the book. Some of his stuff he said, you know, is very, very contemporary. You know, he said when three or four businessmen gather together, it's inevitable that the conversation will eventually turn to how they can conspire to raise prices. So he was no fan of big business. He was a fan of competition. That would force businesses to keep prices tied to costs, to innovate, and the system would be everything go tickety-boo. So in modern terms, Adam Smith actually would have been a big supporter of Lena Khan.
Okay, and the Luddites, which is often an epithet when you get it from a tech bro, but they had a point, although they were brutally punished and ended up losing very badly. But you have a kind word for these abused people. Why?
Yeah, well, partly it's chauvinism. I'm from Leeds, where some of the Luddites hung out. In fact, when I was a kid, I used to play golf on a municipal golf course called Gotts Park, and I never knew anything about it. That was just the name. Turns out it's named after Benjamin Gott, who was one of the first British industrialists and created the first woolen textile factories in Leeds. Manchester beat us to the punch. By about 20 years, they had the cotton factories, but the wool factories were in Leeds. And the golf course I played on turns out to have been the estate of Benjamin Gott. But one of the things he did in running his factories was introduce new mechanical wool shearers. That displaced a lot of, for the time, quite highly paid artisans called croppers, and they were in the vanguard of Ludditism because it was taking away their livelihoods. There weren't that many of them. The woolen textile industry small and the cotton textile industry. The cotton textile industry was huge. It also displaced the famous handloom weavers. I don't know if any historians in the room, but the story of the handloom weavers is a famous sort of example of how capitalism in its sort of creative destruction aspect basically wiped out a whole industry. And a lot of these people that I quote in the book from the 1830s, some of the accounts of parliamentary commissions going and seeing people actually starving to death, because there was no social welfare in those days. So the Luddites, from their perspective, I titled the chapter The Logic of the Luddites. For most of the last 200 years, to call somebody a Luddite has been a term of abuse. It means you're stupid, you're anti-modernity, you're anti-diluvian. In their time, they were some of those things, but it made perfect sense from their point of view. What the Luddites do, they broke into the factories and smashed all the machinery when they could, but there was a very repressive government which started hanging them, and that sort of worked, because the shooting people and hanging them does tend to have a disincentive effect. The movement didn't last for very long. Now, especially with the sort of advent of AI, I think if you worked in the factories in the Midwest, you had sympathy for the Luddites, you know, in the 1980s and 1990s as well. But I think a lot of people in Brooklyn and places are going to start having more sympathy for them in the next few years, too, as AI threatens to displace cognitive workers on a huge scale. And it's not just an economic question. Their critique was mainly moral. They wrote letters and they wrote editorials. They petitioned Parliament. And the question was always, what right do the capitalists, the industrialists, have to take away our livelihoods? And that question has always been sort of lurking underneath capitalism. The justification for the system is obviously in the long term it produces prosperity. The destructive side of it, you know, is offset by the benefits. But when you're at the sharp end of the system, things look different. And the Luddites, I think, were the first to point that out.
Thomas Carlyle, exemplar of reactionary anti-capitalism. Not all anti-capitalism comes from the progressive side. He defended slavery. He had friends in the South. I was reminded of a class I had with Clint Brooks, the old fugitive Southern new critic. It was on Faulkner. And he had a little excursus into the virtues of the slave system as an alternative to Yankee wage labor. What about Carlyle's critique? What is his problem with capitalism?
Carlyle's main problem with capitalism was a bit like the Luddites. It was basically a moral argument. It was basically a critic of the profit motive and the sort of unleashed profit motive plus technology he called the shabbiest gospel ever invented. He saw it as dehumanizing. The early factories were kind of inhuman. You know, they had the majority of the workforce were women and children who until the factory acts of the sort of 1840s were often working 12, 14-hour days. He thought that was morally abhorrent and dehumanizing. Now, he was a great supporter of great men. He'd have been a Trump supporter now, probably on the grounds that, you know, you need strong men. He saw himself as a very moral man. He was a Presbyterian. And he had a lot of support, actually, from the Transcendentalists. That was one of the amazing things which sort of surprised me. Thoreau and people agreed with him because he was a great venerator of nature, too. And he was an early sort of critic of smokestacks despoiling the environment as well, which Ruskin and others took up. So he had various sort of critiques, which are now largely assertive with the left, but they came from the right there. And that strand has always sort of lurked under conservatism. There's always been a sort of inherent tension, I think, between sort of Burkean conservatism, which has a bit of that, and then the sort of Adam Smith conservatism where, you know, as long as the free market says it's okay, it's okay.
I'm speaking with John Cassidy, author of Capitalism and Its Critics, just out from Farrar-Straus and Giroux.
I was happy to see Fred Engels got a whole chapter. I don't think he gets enough respect. But let's talk a bit about my man Marx. You obviously take him quite seriously, but you make a lot of how the prophecies of system collapse and, you know, the endlessly falling rate of profit, which should be deep in negative territory by now, these never became true. Now, I always read those passages of wish fulfillment, but that may be my Freudian speaking. But in any case, I prefer to focus on, you know, his emphasis on exploitation, instability, alienation, and brutality on one hand, and the civilizing progressive aspect of capital on the other hand. And, of course, contradiction is the motor of history. And how much better we could do with our technical and social resources than what we're doing. Nobody did that kind of critique better. So how much do Marx's failures as a prophet take away from his basic analysis?
You know, obviously that's a book in itself. You've probably written a book on it, Doug. I don't know. I haven't. I don't know. There are millions of books. I mean, I've studied Marxist economics as a sort of economic theory and, you know, Schraffian economics. I've done sort of mathematical versions of Marxism. The way I would answer your question is what I tried to do in this book with all the thinkers was not rely on the second-hand accounts. If there is a virtue in the book, it's that I actually went and read the stuff. The basic sources are, you know, it's very hard to plow through Capital, let's be honest. But I did do it, the first volume. I haven't read all the second and third.
I've never gotten through number two. Three is a masterpiece.
Somebody said it's notes, right? I mean, Engels cobbled together a bunch of notes. Obviously, the idea that there was sort of imminent collapse, that hasn't worked out, and the sort of theory of declining rate of profit, you know, some people say that that actually wasn't really in the original Marx, that Engels sort of put that together. I don't think that's true. You have to say, why didn't the, you know, the Marxian prophecies come true? My view of Marx is, as a critique of capitalism, and even as an engine for an analyzing capitalism, it's actually very useful. I started out as a Keynesian. That was my upbringing in Oxford, in England, and all my tutors, I did economics and history. They were all Keynesians. Some of them were left Keynesians, like Joan Robinson, who's in here, but they were ultimately Keynesians. They focused on aggregate demand and thought that if you keep that up, things will be generally pretty good. Over the years, I've come to have more of an appreciation for the sort of leftist critiques of exploitation in various forms. My critique of Marx, if I critique him, are on two levels. Number one, and it may have just been as a product of his time, what has saved capitalism is that wages have gone up. And wages, until 30 years ago, tracked productivity pretty closely. So you had this immensely productive system, total labor-saving investments, but somehow the system, as it destroyed all these jobs and the Luddites, it had created other jobs. And wages in general, this is obviously not true in some particulars, but wages and living standards went up over the years because wages tracked productivity. When Marx and Engels were writing in the early Industrial Revolution, that wasn't true. There's something called Engels' pause in the economic history literature. If you look at the wage data from about 1800 to about 1850 in England, there's very little increase in wages and there's a big increase in profits. That was the world which Marx and Engels grew up in. So that's how they saw capitalism. And if it had stayed like that, it would have collapsed. I think there would have been workers' revolution. They said capitalism creates its own gravediggers. And to some extent, they were right. The system ultimately depends on consent. And I don't think consent would have been given if wages just stayed flat and capitalist profits just went up forever. So what happened? A, the strength of labor unions growth of labor unions, which Marx was always a bit iffy about because he thought they weren't revolutionary enough. B, the state. And I don't think Marx and Engels had any conception that the state could step in and create social insurance programs, welfare programs, free education. I grew up with, you know, free education, free healthcare in the UK. European social democracy, they couldn't conceive of that. And then in the late 19th century, the very late 19th century, when people like Bernstein, Edward Bernstein, came along and said, hang on, things are not actually going as was predicted in Capital and the Communist Manifesto. Workers' wages are going up. Various other predictions are not coming true. That produced a sort of crisis in sort of Marxist leftist thinking, which I think has really never been resolved.
You have a couple of chapters in Early Feminists, Anna Wheeler and Flora Tristan. Names are new to me.
Right.
Tell us about them first, Anna Wheeler.
Well, the reason I did two reasons. Number one, if you look at Bob Heilbronner's book, for example, there are no women in it. Economics has always been very sort of masculine to the extent of being misogynistic, I think. It's starting to change a bit now. So I wanted to put some women thinkers in there, just as a principle. But I also thought you can't tell the history of capitalism without women. They're half the population. In the early Industrial Revolution, they were more than half the workforce in the factories, say, of Manchester, because they were more pliant. And in Massachusetts, obviously, the mills, I do mention them, the famous farm girls who left the farms in Massachusetts to go work in the mills in Lowell and places. So women were part of the labor force. They were the biggest part of the labor force then. So I wanted to include some women. And Marx and Engels always get all the attention when you're writing about socialism. But there was actually a pre-Marxist socialism in Britain and in France. Anna Wheeler and Flora Tristan were associated with various aspects of that. Anna Wheeler was an Irish aristocrat. She had married a drunken Irish ne'er-do-well, and he basically ran through her money and his own money and then left. And then she became abusive, She left him, moved to England and sort of set up a salon with Jeremy Bentham and various sort of the philosophic radicals, as they were known at the time. And she became involved with the other person in the early 19th century I read about, William Thompson. She was sort of his intellectual muse and was a very staunch feminist. So she was sort of the first socialist feminist, I would say, one of them. And Flora Tristan, she was a remarkable woman, an author, a novelist, who then sort of devoted her life to the idea of a universal union, including men and women. All the early labor unions were men only. In Glasgow, they famously had a riot to keep the women out of the sort of artisanal unions. But she had this idea of a universal union which men, women, everybody could join. So I thought she merited a chapter as well. So I tried to keep that thread through it. Joan Robinson's in there. Rosa Luxemburg is in there, another remarkable character. More locally, Silvia Federici and the Wages for Housework movement in the 1970s. It still exists in some forms, but the most famous iteration of it was in New York. Park Slope was where they had their original shop and sort of hangout. Going back to this idea of women playing an essential role in capitalism, I didn't just put them in because I was trying to be feminist. I put them in because I thought it was essential. The Wages for Housework critique is that capitalism has always depended on women, even when they weren't a large part of the labor force, because they reproduced the labor force. There's a famous demonstration back at a Firestone plant by one of the early American feminists. Her show was, you know, you guys can't run this plant without us, because where are the workers coming from? The women, domestic labor, unpaid labor, has always been an important part of, you know, supportive role. Social reproduction, Silvia Federici called it. So there's a chapter on that too.
Is AI going to wreck everything?
That's maybe your next book, Doug, or mine. who am I to say what AI is going to do? I'm not an expert in the technology. I will say that I've been reporting on the sort of economic side of it for a few years now. And if you go speak to the people who are experts in it, both the technologists and the economists who study this stuff, I think the conventional wisdom has shifted. I think 5 years ago, the economists certainly were relatively optimistic. They thought that AI could sort of complement labor, make workers more productive, not just factory workers, but, you know, you think of a doctor with the AI model helping them to make diagnosis, or radiologists or whatever. that's a classic example, or a university lecturer using AI to help him or them or help her produce the lectures. But now when you go talk to them, I spoke to some people at MIT and Harvard and Stanford for a piece I wrote on this, an adaptation of the book for The New Yorker a few weeks ago. It's a lot darker view because of the sort of great rush, profit-driven rush, the way we're seeing since OpenAI turned into a profit-making concern and sold a stake to Microsoft. It's basically just a huge arms race between the various AI companies. It looks like they're just going to rush out as much as they can in terms of displacing labor rather than, there's no restraints on it. There may be models where you don't have any, maybe you still need a surgeon, but do you really need a doctor to diagnose something if the AI program can do it better? Do you need a teacher? I mean, we're seeing it already, you know, kids in school, they all use it. I have a daughter in Princeton who tells me that even the Ivy League now, kids are using AI in exams. The idea, you know, you get a take-home exam, they all just feed it into the AI programs. What's the point of sending your kids to university and paying like a gazillion dollars a year if they're just going to use AI? In the sort of cognitive, educated part of the economy, which we've largely been oblivious to technical progress, not oblivious, but we've benefited from it until recently, I think AI is going to, change the equation. How it's going to change it. I can see an optimistic scenario in which it sort of radicalizes the white-collar worker and they realize they have to sort of stick together or they're going to be displaced. And I can see a very dystopian outcome too, where it's just Elon Musk and a few others running basically everything.
Maybe it's time to reincarnate Ned Ludd.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, as I said, I have more sympathy for the Luddites than I used to have. Someone asked me the other night, they said, but if you want to be a Luddite now, what would you do?
And I smash server farms.
Exactly, that's what I thought. You know, I would imagine they've got pretty heavy security, though.
I would imagine so. towards the end, you toy with the idea of yoking Joe Stiglitz and Silvio Federici and the paleos of national conservatism into some sort of coalition to rein in capitalism. Is that just a momentary fantasy you're playing with? Or you think there's something there?
Well, I mean, it is obviously a fantasy at the moment. There has to be some alternative to sort of the Trumpian economic nationalism, authoritarian model, which is sort of, in political terms, and not in economic terms, but in political terms, is sort of sweeping all before it right at the moment. You know, you just have to look what's happening in Germany and France and even the UK. The most popular party in the UK now is not the Conservative Party or the Labour Party, it's the Reform Party, which is a sort of Trump wannabe party led by Nigel Farage, who's an even bigger shyster than Trump. You can either say, okay, let's burn the system down and replace it completely, which I think in its modern incarnation, I think it's not associated with sort of state socialism anymore and state planning, Gosplan type stuff. I think that's more associated with a sort of radical degrowth movement, which I do have two chapters on. But we have to obviously address climate change and there's going to need to be some radical changes. But to go completely down that path and sort of tell developing countries as well that they can't grow fast, I think is, you know, probably not a practical solution. So coming out of a sort of center-left Keynesian social democratic tradition, I and everybody else in that tradition is basically looking around for what is the 21st century form of a sort of Keynesian social compact. If there was a simple answer to that question, you know, the Labour Party wouldn't be at 20% in the opinion polls after, you know, 6 months in office. The Democratic Party wouldn't be, you know, split asunder, and the French Socialists and the German SPD wouldn't be sort of, you know, heading down the toilet hole of history. It's a great question. In the last chapter, I have some suggestions based on the work of Stiglitz and various others, Danny Roderick, Suresh Naidu up at Columbia, people I'd call centre-leftist, but centre-left rather than radical left. We know some aspects of it. People say, oh, Keynesianism failed, it's a disaster. I don't think that's true. We know some aspects of a system which would be more human. I call it managed capitalism, which people say, oh, you know, that's just an apologia, which I guess to some extent it is. We know some aspects of it which do work. Full employment. For 30 years after sort of 1975, actually 40 years, it was basically wage stagnation in this country. Why was that? Well, in the 70s, we had an economic crisis, and then after that, we basically gave up on full employment. The sort of Milton Friedman's view of the world took over, and full employment became to be defined as 6% unemployment rather than 2% or 3% unemployment. If you run the economy with 6% unemployment, you go back to Marx's reserve army. workers have got no bargaining power. Wages stagnate. Productivity goes up higher than wages. You get rising inequality. That's exactly what we've got. And from about 2015-16 onward, the Fed, to give it its due, has been running the economy to try and reduce unemployment as far as it can go. We got down to the fours and the threes with low inflation. But lo and behold, what happened? Workers' wages started going up, especially at the bottom of the distribution. There's been actually a narrowing of wage inequality in the last 10 years because people at the bottom have sort of started to catch up a bit with people in the middle. Still massive disassociation at the top. So it's not I'm not saying it's a panacea. But full employment is one aspect. Social safety net, the sort of Bernie, Elizabeth Warren agenda, I think, you know, has got a lot to be said for it. The other aspect which does, of course, need to be addressed is how do you fit in the addressing climate change part of it. Biden gets zero credit for it. You know, he did start to sort of provide incentives, big incentives for green energy. It wasn't everything, but it was a lot more than had been done before. So you can see the sort of basic elements of a sort of new Keynesianism, whatever you want to call it. But I don't think it's the economics and the sort of policy side of it, which is that difficult. It's the political economy side of it. Nobody has managed to sell it to the masses. And, you know, if you think about that, where did the Keynesian model come from? It came from the labor movement in the 20th century. There wouldn't have been Keynesian social democracy after the Second World War without a very strong labor movement. There wouldn't have been, you know, the New Deal and the sort of Treaty of Detroit after the Second World War. That was all based on a social compact between labor and capital. Now, in the US and the UK, a large part of the white working class is, you know, in the right-wing populist camp. And, you know, the most alarming thing under Trump was, you know, in the last election, it seemed like a lot of members of the minority working class as well in the US were shifting that direction, certainly Hispanic working class voters. That's an alarm bell for the Democratic Party. So how do you construct a sort of new social bargain when, the workers aren't with you? I think is, you know, a very, very difficult question to answer. And that's why I say, the people who trash all the central left parties, I say to them, yeah, they're not great. I totally agree. But, you know, what's your solution? And I haven't really heard a convincing one.
That kind of central left compromise you're talking about, it's hard to imagine that would be possible without a really seriously radical movement to which that could seem like a sober alternative. We had a Soviet Union, which was a very substantial rival to the U.S., which had an effect on Western capitalism. Right. Can that sort of thing that you're talking about happen without a bunch of frothers pushing the envelope?
No, you need a popular movement. I totally agree. The question is how you construct it. One of the people who's not in the book, probably should be in there, is John Kenneth Galbraith, who had the theory of, you know, countervailing power. To get crude about it, you know, the force of capitalism had their own way for 30, 40 years. And, of course, they're not going to give in unless they're frightened. And they, I'm not talking in terms of necessarily violence, but they're frightened of, you know, very, very high taxes. Basically an attack on all their prerogatives, very, very strong antitrust. Financial repression of the sort that we had after the Second World War, which actually worked pretty well. When they think, you know, the only way you're going to get that sort of agenda is with a sort of mass movement and getting people to the polls, or mass demonstrations. I mean, under Trump, it may come to the fact of, you know, I was speaking to a politician who shall stay unnamed in Washington a couple of weeks ago, and she said, you know, we're getting to sort of general strike type scenarios. You need mass movement, but how do you build a mass movement, Doug, when you don't have the labor movement? Now, you know, there are environmental movements. There have been some strenuous efforts to unionize the sort of service sector of the economy. One of the things Biden was trying to do was to sort of strengthen the care economy. Never got anywhere. That was the part of the Build Back Better agenda which got cut out. The ideas are there. It's how do you mobilize people? Maybe I ask you, how do you do it?
Not me. I wish I knew.
That was John Cassidy, author of Capitalism and Its Critics, A History, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. This is an excerpt from a conversation we had about it at the Center for Brooklyn History on May 15th. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
Well-mannered, good hands, and greasy smiles enticing the
That was some of the Procession of Popular Capitalism, a 1987 mega-hit by the English Marxist indie pop band McCarthy. The band's name was an homage to Joe. Next, Abundance. Two deeply neoliberal writers, Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson, have gotten a lot of press for their new book called Abundance. You might expect a book with such a title to have a subtitle, but it doesn't. I have no interest in reading it. From what I've seen and heard of it, it's not terribly novel or appealing, but the authors do have the ear of some Democrats looking for a way out of the political wilderness. But I was interested in the review of the book by Sandeep Vahisan in the Boston Review, not only because it cataloged the book's shortcomings, but also because it had some rich suggestions for a progressive view of real abundance. Sandeep is legal director at the Open Markets Institute and author of Democracy and Power, A History of Electrification in the United States. Sandeep Vahisan. Let's start looking at their general critique. Even if the original concerns are good, concern for the environment, social justice, the left end of the spectrum is currently perceived as anti-growth, degrowth even, and that's making life worse and giving the right a political opening. What do you think of that general line before we get to the specifics?
Yeah, I think it's off base. The left supports the ends articulated in this book of universal, decent, affordable housing, abundant, clean energy. So when they call those of us who are, broadly speaking, to their left, degrowthers, they are being extremely unfair and uncharitable and not recognizing that it's not so much the ends that we disagree with, it's rather their means. And in my view, their means are wholly inadequate to what they're proposing to do. It's really neoliberalism in a new bottle presented as something new and exciting when it's really just the latest iteration of what we've been doing for the last half century.
That being
broadly lifting public controls on private corporations, channeling money to these corporations to purportedly advance the public interest. That broadly sums up the book. I don't think I'm really doing too much violence to their thesis when I say that they want it to be easier for the private sector to build, and when the private sector doesn't want to build, we should channel more money, broadly free of conditions, to the private sector to build housing, to build energy, to build broadband, etc.
So who are these bad if well-intentioned sorts who are stifling growth and making life harder for everyone?
The villain of their book is professional class liberals, people...
Everybody hates them these days.
Everybody hates them, the PMC. So they target this group and they say, you know, these people have generally progressive outlook. They think of themselves as tolerant and broad-minded. But according to Klein and Thompson, they're really the ones standing in the way of new housing development, renewable energy development. And so ironically, these people who fashion themselves as progressive are rather conservative in the view of Klein and Thompson. So they say that these are the people standing in the way of progress, and in a sense, they are asking this group to engage in some self-criticism, self-reflection, think about what they're doing that's harmful, and then, I think more concerningly, ask other parts of society to view the PMC as the villain, as the obstacle to a better society.
Now, it seems quaint to bring this up, given the Trump administration, but... We hear about these, like, NIMBY types who don't want windmills spoiling their Cape Cod views. This is inhibiting green energy development. Is there any truth to these cliches at all?
This book is heavily reliant on anecdotes, and so we can certainly find stories that validate their thesis. We can find examples of affluent people opposing renewable energy projects. We can certainly find examples of affluent suburbanites resisting the construction of affordable public housing in their neighborhoods. There's something there. It's not as though their thesis is devoid of support. It's just not systematically supported. It's one of those books that relies heavily on sensational stories to make its point. For example, I agree with them that many suburban areas across the country should be upzoned. They're not dense enough. They have the capacity to support more people. We should upzone them. But we should also be clear-eyed about what this is going to achieve. And I think this reveals a major blind spot in the book. So their view is, if the state steps out of the way, the private sector will build, and it'll build on a very large scale. And I think a fundamental problem with the book is they don't actually grapple with the logic of investment when the private sector decides to invest, when it doesn't, and importantly, when banks and other lenders are willing to support a project. In their simple telling, the private sector almost has this animalistic urge to build stuff, and it's the public sector that's standing in the way. And so you hear nary a word about expected profits and finance and credit. It's just the private sector wants to build stuff, and the public sector and professional class NIMBYs just need to get out of the way.
Let's talk some about housing specifically. We've just been through a rise in housing prices through the pandemic and after that came with little new construction. That's very much unlike the housing bubble of what, 15 or 20 years ago. Now, according to Freddie Mac, we're, I think, it's something like 3 to 5 million units short on housing. To the likes of the abundance boys, the problem is one of government regulation, zoning, stifling, as you said, the private sector. But how do you see the problem? What is holding back the development of housing, and how can we close that 3 to 5 million unit gap?
Clearly, the fundamental problem is the private sector doesn't see enough profits going forward. They need sustainably rising prices to make it worthwhile to build. And so in places where there's been a huge run-up in prices over the past 10, 15 years, Austin is the popular example, there has been significant construction. But the construction bursts tend to be fairly short-lived. As soon as prices come down a little bit, as soon as projected prices are expected to decrease, the developers pump the brakes on new construction. That's exactly what's happening in Austin. And so it's a story of inadequate profits. And so they indirectly address this. They say one thing we can do is we can reduce the cost of housing construction, which would boost profitability in this sector. And yes, in principle, that's true. But the devil's in the details. How do you go about lowering costs? They actually target the construction sector, view it as a source of inefficiency, excessively high wages. The conservative anti-labor theme in this book really comes out when they're talking about how to bring housing costs down. Another example that's received a lot of attention is when they talk about public funding for housing development in California. There's a condition saying that if a multifamily complex is built near major highway, that the developer has to install special air filters to ensure clean indoor air. Seems perfectly reasonable. I think clean indoor air should be a basic right, not a luxury. But Klein and Thompson say this is the sort of excessive public conditioning that prevents the private sector from taking public money and building. The alternative might be homelessness, so isn't it better that people live in an apartment with dirty air than live in a tent under an overpass? And, you know, I think it's a very simplistic dichotomy. And I think more fundamentally, it reveals a basic logic of scarcity that runs throughout this book. You know, I don't think clean indoor air is something extraordinary, certainly not in a country as wealthy as the United States in 2025.
And what about public housing? I would imagine they're not interested in that.
No, they don't really talk much about that. You know, they certainly don't make an affirmative case for it. To the extent that they address it, they say that it's impeded by the same barriers facing private sector housing development. So the book is very much concerned with state public barriers to private sector development. And to the extent that they talk about the state doing more, it's largely the state should be giving more money to the private sector to build and pursue socially desirable activities.
The argument a lot of this book seems to be, and not just coming from these two characters, but the whole sector of neoliberal pundits, the private sector is just suffering from a pent-up demand to invest that's hampered by the administrative state. You know, this is thinking is behind not only these sorts, but the Trump administration as well. What do you think of that argument?
It's a largely specious argument. A term and concept that they invoke both in the book and in their interviews and speeches is the idea of state capacity. And you know, I think this is a way of bringing lefties on board with their program. We want state capacity. We want the state to be able to do more. And there is inadequate state capacity in the United States. If you look at a number of federal agencies, they have fewer people now than they did in the 1960s and 1970s, even though we have a much bigger population, much bigger economy.
Fewer than they did a few months ago, too.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, we've seen this accelerate under Musk and Trump. So state capacity is good. We should be building up state capacity to do things better, to do new lines of work. But their vision of state capacity is radically different than the conventional progressive left view of state capacity. Their view is the state should be very efficient at authorizing private sector projects and effectively channeling subsidies to the private sector developers, which is not how I conventionally understand state capacity. It's a very neoliberal account of the state. The state is aiding and enabling private sector activity. In a sense, it's a new term for public-private partnerships. And I think Musk has been a very inconvenient individual for their story, because
he has certainly been the beneficiary of a lot of public assistance.
Right. He's become the world's richest man thanks to very liberal public sector support since the mid-2000s. And, you know, they have this idea, they call it everything bagel liberalism, where public money is bogged down with too many conditions. You know, we're expecting the private sector to do too much. We can imagine a scenario where that's true, but, you know, their vision of liberalism is something like what the federal government has done for Musk, you know, given him a lot of money to develop EVs, to launch rockets into space. And it's certainly been a very attractive partnership for him, but I think the public benefits are modest and in some cases harder to divine. So to the extent that we want to pursue their vision of liberalism, we're seeing it in real time with Musk.
Turning to a positive model, you look at the New Deal as something we can learn a lot from, particularly like the electrification that the New Deal perpetrated. It took public action to do things that the private sector would not do. So can you talk about the New Deal as a model? What can we learn from that?
When Franklin Delano Roosevelt took office in 1933, the United States was still a substantially rural country, and the vast majority of people in the countryside didn't have electricity. So in 1933, only about 1 in 10 farmers had power. And the reason is the private sector simply thought it was not a profitable line of business. It would cost a lot of money to build power lines in these thinly populated areas, and these hick farmers, in their view, wouldn't actually use much electricity. Roosevelt's view was, electricity is no longer a luxury, it's a necessity. Everyone should have low-cost, abundant electricity. And since the private sector wasn't going to do it, the state should step in. And so what the New Deal state did was really twofold. First, it set up a program to extend low-cost credit to rural electrification projects, which were mainly done by community-owned rural electric cooperatives. The federal government gave them long-term cheap credit to build rural lines. And second, the federal government entered the power business on a very large scale through entities like the Tennessee Valley Authority, which built and operated hydroelectric dams. The broad vision was what Roosevelt called yardstick competition. He said, the aim here isn't full nationalization of the power sector, it's to create what we might call a public option to expand the supply of electricity in the United States, and then also to force the private sector to do better through institutional competition, public-private competition instead of public-private partnerships. And this program of investment and credit was extraordinarily successful. Rates of rural electrification went from about 1 in 10 in 1935 to more than 9 in 10 in the mid-1950s. So my view is, if we're serious about affordable, abundant housing, abundant clean energy, it's going to take a program closer to the Rooseveltian program of public investment and public planning to accomplish that. And the simple neoliberal model that the authors of Abundance articulate is not going to be nearly up to the task of what they purport.
Yeah, the neoliberal approach would be tax credits or something, or maybe some subsidies to the corporations, but nothing this ambitious.
Nothing this ambitious. I think Klein and Thompson would favor an approach heavily reliant on carrots, you know, tax credits, as you say. If you build a wind farm, you can get a tax credit once the project is up and running. Public sector certainly won't be involved in building and operating clean energy facilities. Rather, it would be trying to drag the private sector kicking and screaming to do the right thing. So it's a radically different program than what the New Dealers did.
They also pushed regulation of utilities in areas where they're established.
That's right, that's right. Roosevelt said that private ownership should remain the norm in the power sector, but the private utility should be much more tightly regulated, both at the federal and state level. And so his vision was private utilities would be allowed to earn reasonable profits, but the profit motive would be tempered by this public service mandate. And it's remarkable. Abundance, for all its focus on energy, does not address the fact that the power sector has been extensively regulated for more than a century. They don't talk about how regulation should be done going forward. Their view is, in large measure, the public sector just needs to stand down. Let the private sector deliver abundance.
Finally, how could we put this to work today, this New Deal precedent? There's, you know, a little of this under Obama, some under Biden, but much of it was small and poorly publicized. So what would be good today for promoting a real abundance based on this New Deal model?
So at least in the near term, you know, probably shouldn't expect much from the federal government. I don't expect breathe new life into the Tennessee Valley Authority. But the good thing is many of these publicly owned utilities are actually exist at the state and local level. And so one encouraging example that's actually quite live is the New York Power Authority, which is a publicly owned utility set up during Governor Franklin D. Roosevelt's time in 1931, that owns hydroelectric plants on the St. Lawrence and Niagara Rivers, and was given authority in 2023 to build large-scale renewable projects. And I think this is a very good template. You know, there's a very active and intense fight over how much the New York Power Authority is going to build. Many of the DSA members in the New York Assembly want New York Power Authority to err on the side of going big. They recognize that the private sector actually hasn't built much renewable energy in New York. And if New York's going to meet its fairly aggressive climate goals, NYPA is going to have to step up. Unfortunately, NYPA is under the control of an administrator who doesn't seem to believe in public power, wants to do as little as possible under his statutory mandate. But the good news is he's facing a lot of scrutiny from the public, from members of the assembly, and is facing real pressure to do more. You know, we'll see what he ultimately does, but it's a very ongoing and live fight right now.
That was Sandeep Vahesan, legal director at the Open Markets Institute and author of a first-rate review of Klein and Thompson's book, Abundance, published in the Boston Review. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Electricity by Captain Beefheart. Till next week, bye.
Shout the truth peacefully.